thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Hey everyone, Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello, and this week on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we're trying something different. We're airing an authentic media snapshot, as we call it. It's a portion of one of the shows that are military aviation based from our friends over at Authentic Media. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here we go.
Hi, this is Craig Snyder, call sign Crunch, and this is Airboss.
This is Authentic.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the newest podcast. You may remember me from the F-14 Tomcast. My name is Craig Snyder, call sign Crunch. And as you recall, Bio Baranek and I did a one-year, 26-episode program all about flying the Tomcat. Well, we have a new podcast where we're going to dive into an entire series on Airboss and the Air Department on a carrier. I am joined by my good friend, Commander Shannon Coulter, call sign Flash, and we're going to go through this 6-episode series talking all about everything that you might want to know. A little bit about me, as you may recall from the F-14 Tomcast experience, is that I am an F-14 pilot. I'm an F-18 pilot. I spent some time flying all models and series of the F-14 A through D and the F-18 A through F. I spent some time as a Top Gun instructor pilot. I was also an air boss on the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower. Flash, how are you doing?
Hey, Crunch, how you doing? It's good to be with you this morning. My background, I was an F-14 radar intercept officer, or RIO, and spent quite a few years with the privilege to fly that fine aircraft. I only made it up through the B model, didn't get to see all the fancy stuff going on there in the Delta, but the B was a pretty impressive airplane as well. More relevant to what we're going to talk about here, once I got done with my flying tours there in the Tomcat, I moved on and eventually became your mini boss on Eisenhower, which was a great experience. We ended up doing actually 2 deployments, right? We had a 6-monther there from July through December, and then we the leadership had the wisdom to bring us home for a break for a couple months. Then we had to back out for 4 more months after that. So a little unusual, but a lot of experience on Ike. And then I actually followed that tour up with a strike operations tour, which is essentially the scheduling department on Eisenhower. And then once I got done there, I moved on to Naval Air Systems Command in Patuxent River, Maryland, and started working for PMA 251 as their class desk, which is essentially fleet liaison type work, going from the 50-pound egghead engineering kind of guys out to the fleet and vice versa. I retired in 2019, and they couldn't find a replacement for me. So I basically just took off the jammies and put on some khakis, and I've been working for those guys ever since. So PMA 251 is responsible for ALRAE, or Aircraft Launch and Recovery Equipment, ALRAE all day. And specifically, I'm working for AAG, the Advanced Arresting Gear and Electromagnetic Aircraft Launching System, AAG and EMALS, on Ford. And I'm the Ford Assistant Program Manager for Systems Engineering out there, and have been for the last 3 years.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited that we're both on this, and I think that you're bringing a wealth of knowledge, and everybody's going to be really excited to hear about all the new technology coming out on the Ford and what it means for the future of the fleet. So what is the concept of this podcast is that we are going to step through the Air Department. We're going to talk about the flight deck, the hangar deck. We're going to talk about the catapults, the resting gear, the aviation fuel system, the tower, the handler, the Ouija board. We're going to talk about the steam catapults and the emails. We're going to talk about traditional resting gear and advanced arresting gear, and we're going to talk about flight operations going out to about 5 miles from the ship both day and night. And we're going to have a real fun episode when we get a bunch of shooters on and have a conversation about what it's like to be a shooter on the catapults, shooting those airplanes off over your head at night and burner. It'll be a lot of fun. So that's the concept of what we're going to do.
Yeah, I think we're going to approach this in, as if we were doing a Tiger Cruise, right? And we've got a bunch of visitors who are vaguely familiar with what their young men and women are doing at sea. They've heard a lot of stories, but they've never seen it in person. And I think there's a lot of things going on in the background that casual fans of naval aviation may not be aware of. And it's a really great opportunity to shine a light on the youngsters who are working really hard below decks to enable the superstars to get off the deck and go do great things airborne.
Awesome. All right. So that's the summary. That's it for episode zero. Like I said, we're going to be doing six episodes. Should be take us about a month to put all of these out. After you hear this one, we should be rolling right into episode one. So we're going to get started on that right now. And let's get started. So today's episode, we're talking about the differences between a Nimitz-class carrier with steam catapults and conventional resting gear and the new Ford class of carrier with EMALS, the fancy new electric catapults, and the AAG, the advanced arresting gear. So Flash, you know so much about these systems. You've been up to your eyeballs in the Ford. You were on board for what, 93% of their traps so far? It's been underway for several years, and you've been underway the whole time, right?
Yeah, just about, real close. So for sure, more than 90%. They were out there here in November, and I was back ashore, thankfully. But yeah, real close.
How many traps have you witnessed on board the ship? On the
How many traps have I missed?
Witnessed.
Witnessed? 11,000 plus.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So, she's got 12,000 under her belt, and I've been out there for 11,000 of them. So,
that's incredible. All right, that's amazing. That is absolutely. So, did you get a special cake? You like for the 10,000?
Yeah, though, the ship had a special cake. Yeah, the ship got a cake for 10,000.
Oh, that's funny. Awesome. So let's, big picture, what's email? You want to talk about emails or AAG first? What do you want to do?
Well, I tell you what, I thought maybe we'd do a quick overview, right? Of everything and get into.
Because there's more than that, isn't there?
Yeah, our specialty, right? And so I want to preface this with nothing I'm about to say isn't fully available on the internet. Anybody can go read it anytime they want. I don't want anyone concerned that we're giving away the nation's secrets or anything like that. And with that being said, it's been a while, right? Nimitz commissioned, which is, basically our last class of carrier, the Nimitz class carrier. USS Nimitz was commissioned in 1975. So you're looking at, nearly 50 years ago. Bush, which is a variation on Nimitz, still a Nimitz-class carrier, but she's the first one that went to the three-wire configuration. She has what we call fat cats or C-13 TAC-2 cats, which are larger pistons, right? A bigger shotgun. And then Ford, commissioned in 2017, and obviously the lead member of the Ford class of aircraft carriers. You got Kennedy, Enterprise, and Doris Miller, CVN 81, coming on her heels here next up. So in general, Ford is designed with two A1B Bechtel reactors, and Bechtel kind of took over the reactor business from Westinghouse.
I did not know that.
It's their initial foray into naval nuclear power.
Is a U.S. company, right?
Yeah, we can only hope, right? No. Yeah. They're U.S. They specialize in nuclear power plants, right? They build 80% of the power plants in the nation, kind of a thing. So it's not like they're inexperienced. They don't know what they're doing. It's just their initial run into the world of carrier nuclear generators. So the thing about these power plants, right, as opposed to our Nimitz class carriers, is they are designed to produce electricity instead of steam. So they produce about three times the amount of, and their supporting equipment, right, the turbine generators, et cetera, produce about three times the amount of electricity that the Nimitz class reactors did. And so the only thing that we use steam for is to drive those turbine generators, which then, translate into shaft power for the ship, right? And if you remember, when we were in the Gulf, and you have to share steam between the shafts and the catapults, well, sometimes we would be launching and have to take a little time out while we built steam back up on the cats, if we had, you know, an extremely hot day, so very low density altitudes with extremely low winds. So we're making a whole bunch of speed through the water and we're using a whole bunch of steam to do that. And then we're trying to siphon off some of that steam to run the cats. And if you're shooting four cats and so you're using up that steam at a high rate, then you can't sustain it, right? And so with EMALS, which is obviously completely electric, right? There, you don't have to split the steam between the shafts and the catapults. And therefore, there's no such thing as a break required if you run into a condition where you've got to go full bore with a high density altitude type situation and you want to keep launching.
So real quick though, so the purpose of the nuclear reactor, so you got two of them on the Ford class, you got two reactors, they still produce heat, which creates steam, right?
Right.
And the steam drives the turbines that move the shafts for the propellers through the water. And then I'm sure some of it is then used for turbines to spin electric generators, right?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
And so regardless of the load on those electric generators, it still gets the same amount of supply of steam. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah.
Roughly. I mean, neither one of us is nuclear.
And I'm not a nuke, right? So, I mean, the important takeaway for
roughly,
me,
for the, that's the, yeah, for the, roughly, that's the
basic
concept.
Guy, for the basic guy, it's just, hey, I don't have to give away steam to run catapults. I can dedicate all of my heat and my steam power generation to the shafts and then running the turbine generators for electricity.
So that's a really good point. And, you know, you and I have spent a lot of time on nuclear carriers, and that was always a big thing that you had to share steam. You know, it doesn't matter what you're using it for, whether it's creating hot water for the ship, you know, whatever the case is, creating fresh water, you know, holy cow. I wonder how that system works.
You can do all kinds of cool stuff with that extra electricity, right? Not only does the electricity support EMALS, but it also supports dual band radar, which is, you know, much newer and a whole different transformational technology over our rotational radars. Right now, I can't remember what they're called, SPS 49 and 48. Or
41.
Spin 41 was our approach radar.
Sorry.
Spin 41 is ILS, right? So just the one way. Spin 46 was our approach radar two way, back and forth with the airplane for auto landing modes, right?
Right. ACLS, automated carrier landing.
Yeah. ACLS. System. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So and then if you wanna have fancy toys in the future, you know, suppose somebody invent some Star Wars laser beams or something in the next 25 or 10 years or whatever, you've got tons of electricity to support those kinds of weapons that don't, you know, that need that kind of extra power, right?
Interesting. Okay, so that's a neat nuance I was unaware of. It's obvious now that you say it. I was completely unaware that that's how it was designed. So that's cool.
Yeah, it
so
is.
What it, it is yeah, cool, so, yeah, so you got all this extra energy, this extra electricity, and first, well, maybe you got more to talk about, but I mean, you're diverting a lot of that goes to the catapults, right? I mean, got to figure they draw a ton of that electricity when they need it, right?
Yeah. We'll keep going with the Ford basics. I'll come back to EMALS and AEG, but you are,
I'm a simple guy. I want to talk about flying. I want to talk about launching and landing. But what's the, it's Disneyland, right?
Right. So, on a related note, right? Because you do bring up a good point. We're here to talk about flying. So
But everybody wants to hear about the Ford because there's so much neat stuff here. So please continue. Yeah.
She has 50% more AC plant capability because you got to cool all the electronics she's got, including our stuff. She has.
But all that air conditioning, it all goes to the electronics. I bet none of it goes to berthing or the staterooms, does it?
You are incorrect, sir. So Ford is the coldest ship I have ever been on in my life. And people will tell you that. They will remark, if you visited Ford, you would come out of there going, why was I wearing a coat in the middle of the summer? Right? So that is true. I've been in staterooms literally in the middle of the summer and it's 85, 90 degrees outside. And we are in our sleeping bags with our sweats on and a jacket on and your little nose is freezing off.
That is incredible.
That ship produces air conditioning like I have never seen a ship produce air conditioning. So
that's awesome.
And it goes everywhere. It is in your stateroom. It's in the electronic spaces. It's everywhere. So it's pretty impressive the amount of AC she can put out. She's got 10 stores elevators versus two. We talked a little bit about DBR. That's going to be a one-off for Ford because they're moving to the Enterprise Air Surveillance Radar for CBN 79 and beyond.
Back up. DBR?
Dual band radar. So air surveillance search radar, and it doubles as a surface search radar. Does everything, right?
It handles
all of her requirements. And then, you know, weapons elevators. She has 11 versus 9 on Nimitz, and they each have about 2.5 times the load-bearing capacity of Nimitz. And then there's a dedicated weapons handling area. So, you know, on Nimitz, if you got into a hot war and you had to build up a bunch of weapons in a hurry, then it was on the mess decks, right? They converted the mess decks to a weapons handling area. On Ford, the weapons handling area is dedicated, and that's its sole purpose in life is to move ordnance, to build weapons and move them through that weapons area and get them to the flight deck. And then the way that the weapons elevators are arranged on the flight deck, they kind of deconflict with the parking areas so that you can use them, right? While you're conducting flight operations. And so that's also another cool feature.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
They redesigned the flight deck, moved the island well aft, and made somewhere between 6 and 8 more parking spots forward of the island. And what that does is, obviously, you don't have to reposition airplanes as much after you land them. You can park them forward of the island. That's where you're going to do quick maintenance, refuel, rearm, and get them right back out, right? And then they designed the flight deck in a kind of this pit stop concept where they embedded refueling stations in the flight deck. Like, Nimitz has no refueling stations anywhere but the catwalks. Nimitz has 17 refueling stations, Ford has 40. Those 6 refueling stations in the flight deck, you can just grab a hose, go straight to the nearest airplane. And the great thing about that is, like, if you and I were refueling planes on Fighter Row, we had to drag that hose across the street. And now you can't taxi any airplanes in there.
That's right.
Whereas on Ford, those refueling stations are in the flight deck right next to Fighter Row. And so you don't have fuel hoses crossing the street. And now you can taxi guys in and out of there while you're still refueling Bubba's on Fighter Row, et cetera.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. And then also, I think about this, so you land and you clear the landing area, you de-arm. And a lot of times, you know, especially if you're a Tomcat type guy, you know, you're going to be turned to the right and you're going to be stuffed somewhere while they wait for the recovery to complete before they taxi you aft to shut you down and do the switch. When you have all these extra spots forward of the island, they can just actually chalk and chain you, shut you down. You've already started the maintenance. You've already started swapping crews. Wow, what a great process for improving turnaround time. That's amazing.
Yeah, that is exactly the idea. I think we discussed previously, JBD-2 doesn't foul the LA, so you can recover simultaneously off of JBD-2. JBD-full is a full-sized JBD, so you don't have any restrictions on afterburner shots on JBD-4. Mm-hmm. You can take a fully loaded aircraft off 4 and not have to worry about it.
And the difference being that on the Nimitz class, if I'm not mistaken, it's a 3-panel JBD on Cat 4. Isn't that right? I'm trying to think.
I don't think it's 3. I think it's either 4. It's a minimum of 4, but it's either 4 or 5. I want to say it's 4 panels on JBD.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm making stuff up then.
Yeah, there are 6 total panels for a normal JBD, I know that Cat 4 on Nimitz is not a three panel JBD. It's at least four. I kind of thought it was five, but I could be wrong.
It's something less than a full size JBD on
Cat
4.
It absolutely is. Yeah. It absolutely is.
And you're saying, and on a forward glass, I've got a full JBD, so I can do anything. Because like a Tomcat was not able to go onto Cat 4 and go into afterburner on Cat 4. And I think...
Hornet,
a baby Hornet could. I think a Super Hornet could. Right. But I mean, there was just more jet blast going around this thing because it was narrower.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, cool.
So all those things together combine to produce a higher sortie generation rate for Ford over Nimitz. So the whole idea, right, behind the team is to get combat power projected downrange. And so the faster that we can turn around airplanes in terms of refueling, rearming, maintaining, then the more sorties we can stick in the air per a given amount of time, right?
Right.
And that's all of those things we just talked about contribute to turning airplanes around faster. And I think there's a common misconception out there, you tell me, maybe not, that EMALS and AAG, so our catapults and arresting gear, somehow contribute to this faster sortie rate, but they don't. And the reason they don't is because they were dictated that the interfaces between the aircraft and the equipment had to be identical. And that makes a lot of sense, right? We can't introduce a new piece of equipment that then requires us to redesign the entire aviation fleet and potentially making them heavier or incompatible with Nimitz, right? We can't have Ford airplanes and Nimitz airplanes. We need airplanes that are the same on both, and the pilots should not know the difference. And they don't in terms of their procedures, right? The way that they approach the catapult, the way they arrest, et cetera. As far as the pilot's concerned, there is no difference. The difference is all below decks. And so because of that, your limiting factor is how fast can I load an airplane onto the catapult or how fast can I recover an airplane? And AAG and EMALS don't affect that equation at all. It takes a certain amount of time to taxi over the shuttle, to do the same steps that we do on Nimitz in terms of taking tension and stepping up the cat and launching it, et cetera. So those numbers, as far as how long it takes you to do all that, are the same for both pieces of equipment.
Gotcha. Now, the only limitation, if I'm not mistaken, you cannot shoot two catapults at the same time, right? You cannot do a covey launch with EMALS?
Yes, that's correct. That is a software limitation that they built in, you know, back in the day. And I'm not sure, you know, who came up with that. But yeah, it's a software, like,
so
no
it's
matter
a
who
software
wants
limitation.
To do it, you can't do it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I had thought it was basically a capacitor charging issue. I mean, I assume they're big giant capacitors, but that's not the case. It actually is.
No, there is plenty of energy in EMALS, and so I guess we'll just transition to EMALS, right? Because you asked before about about how
I keep throwing you off your game here, but
no
yeah,
no, it's great. So EMALS, the electromagnetic aircraft launch system, right, is kind of magic, right? I mean if you think about it, we're throwing 70,000 pounds of metal airborne with a magnet, but really with electricity that's producing magnetism,
right.
But there is no physical contact between the energy source and the bullet, if you will, right? You don't have steam pushing a piston. You just have magnetism grabbing a 2,000-pound armature and throwing it down the deck. And so it's a little freaky the first time you see it or you're near it. There's no slam from the water break, right? There's no such thing as a water break. So when these things get to the end of the catapult, they just reverse the magnetic field and it just goes and stops. There's no thump. There's no nothing.
It stops in like the span of like 2 or 3 feet, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe
less.
Yeah,
it's a little more than that. It's something on the order of 12 feet or so it takes to reverse all that. You know, it's we can get it up to some pretty significant knots. So it takes a little bit to get that thing reversed, but it's quick and it's silent. And we used to, like, if you launch a prop on Ford, the island is so far aft of Cat 1 and Cat 2, actually even Cat 3 and Cat 4. But if you launch a prop on Ford and you're not watching it happen, you won't know it happened because you can't.
Wow.
The props are too quiet and there is zero sound out of the catapult. You know, there's no thump at the end. Like on Nimitz, you know, every time there's a launch, you know,
right.
On forward.
Yeah. You'll be down in the dirty short wardroom of forward,
right.
And having dinner and the catapult strokes and all the dishes shake and the water glasses are spilling over and everything. But not in this case, it just goes.
Yeah. Every time the water breaks go. So we were talking about the reactor and EMALS. The way it works is the reactor sends a whole bunch of power to our motor generators, and our motor generators are just kinetic flywheel storage devices, right? So you've got a huge flywheel, you spin it up to X amount of RPM, and then it doesn't take very much energy to keep it spinning at that RPM. And when we're doing flight ops, that's it. Those things are always spinning at that RPM. Then when you want to launch, you trade just a little fraction of that kinetic energy for a pulse of electricity. And by pulse, you know, we're talking about three to four seconds of output. And all that power is fed into one catapult. And that's what generates your magnetic field, which is then sequenced through motor modules that are spaced down the cat. And that's your launching impetus. So the only recovery time is just how long does it take to spin those motor generators back up to a launching RPM. But secret sauce, they don't ever get below launching RPM. So you can just launch. The software keeps you from launching two at the same time. But basically, you can launch them as fast as the next shooter can turn around and get the next one going. So tactically, even though you don't have the cool cubby, two airplanes coming off at identically the same time, tactically you get airplanes off just as fast as Nimitz can. They're just sequenced instead of, you know, two at a time.
So so there's a software limit that says you can't do it at the same time. What is the time difference that the software, if you can tell us?
Yeah,
what's the minimum?
It's in the neighborhood of 30-ish seconds, right? It's a little less.
Okay.
Than that, but yeah. But you know, every 30 seconds you can get one off, and you can actually do better than that. But I don't know where that's floating around. So we'll keep that exact number to ourselves. But somewhere
around 30 seconds. Good.
Yeah, you can do better than 30 seconds.
All right.
So well, that's interesting. Like, you know, how fast do carriers go? 30 knots.
That's right.
They can do quite a bit more than that.
So I've heard. So awesome. So I've always heard some bad gouge. This is really interesting because I had heard that it would take, you know, you would launch one and then it would take a full minute to recharge the capacitors before you could fire number two. But that is absolutely not the reason, and it's not true. So that's really cool that we talked about that because it's just not the case. Now, that said, let's say I'm on Cat 1 and I launch an airplane. And we talked about how it's the same as a normal Nimitz class. How long do you think it would take a normal shooter, flight and topside crew to launch an airplane as soon as that one hits the end of the stroke to then load the next airplane, get them in tension, get it ready to go, and shoot again with no other restrictions? Just that one cat.
Yeah, how so fast? That's mostly crew dependent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I would say, I mean, if a crew is on fire, they can mm-hmm. knock that out in about 2 minutes. I think we expect 2.5 and we plan for 3.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if that rings a bell at all, we plan for a 3 minute, launch to launch. We plan for mm-hmm. 3 minutes. A crew that is proficient and knows what they're doing, they should be able to hit 2.5 minutes. If you've got, you know, a team that just is on fire, you might mm-hmm. be able to hit 2:15, you know, for a launch.
And so between a Ford, between a Nimitz, that number doesn't change. It's all the same.
Yeah, exactly. It's a limitation of just how fast you can taxi an airplane safely and get mm-hmm. it engaged with the catapult. And as far as what you see on the flight deck, other than no steam rolling out of the trough, you can't mm-hmm. tell the difference. It's still a shuttle. There's still a launch bar. Still got to taxi the airplane. And all the procedures for the shooter are, you know, essentially the same.
So now we're going to talk some shooter stuff on a later episode. Maybe we should save that. But when a shooter is planning to launch an airplane, he's checking the wind speed versus the weight versus the launch valve setting just to make sure that everything is correct. I'm sure EMALS is very similar. Is it the same? I mean, how does...
Yeah, that, that CSV setting for Nimitz class carriers, which is what the something selector valve, right? Is it common or? Anyway, I know it's a CSV.
Yeah.
I just can't remember the actual name of the setting.
I don't either.
But it basically controls how long the launch valve is open, which tells you how much steam you add behind the piston, right? Mm-hmm. Before it closes. So and then I don't know if we want to let the shooters talk about it or whatever, but the steam heats
they can talk up about it as well.
Those pistons, right? Yeah. And that's where you get, and we call that an elongation when the pistons heat up. And there, I don't know how many people know this or not, but if you go on the flight deck of a Nimitz class carrier and you go to the end of the cat track, there is actually a ruler, you know, like stamped in metal down there with a little pointer on it. And when a piston heats up, it can move as much as six to 10 to 12 inches over the course of the day as it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And it becomes a little more efficient as it heats up. And so you have to overcompensate with more steam or more power as the elongs expand. So they take into account, you know, the weather, which essentially equates to density altitude, how many Bernoullis are floating around the air out there. They take into account the elongs from the catapult. And then, of course, the common sense stuff, how much wind is coming over the deck, because that's going to affect how much end speed I need to give that airplane to go flying. So EMALS has none of that, right? You just, mm-hmm. well, no, sorry, let me rephrase that.
It
the
has wind.
Wind certainly applies. Yeah. The density altitude certainly applies, but there's no such thing as elongs. And I will say that we always say that EMALS is consistent, powerful, and precise. And you're like, well, okay. Remember that on every single catapult in the United States, every single steam catapult in the United States Navy is different. And meaning they're built the same, right? But they produce a different amount of end speed because of the variabilities of an analog system, right? Like one launch valve might be just a tick faster than another launch valve for the same setting, right? The holes get worn at a different rate and they experience different environmental factors, et cetera. So, you know, for each catapult, Lakehurst will come down or VRT will come down and CAVSU, and they'll take very precise measurements and say, okay, if we give you exactly this much,
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Thanks for listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast and this Authentic Media snapshot. If you like what you heard, head over to Authentic Media on your favorite podcast platform for complete episodes and a whole lot more. We'll see you next time. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.